Welcome, everyone, to our next series on the Build and Revitalize podcast. I'm Jason Chaney, Senior Consultant and Due Diligence Discipline Lead with SME, and your host for this series on environmental due diligence. A couple months ago, Dave and I were out having a beverage and waxing poetic on the topic of due care obligations. You can only imagine the crowd that gathered around us. That moment was the birth of this multi-part series. We'll be covering the importance of due diligence prior to property transactions, what to do after acquisition, risks associated with property acquisition, and what happens when things don't go to plan. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in again to Build and Revitalize for our series on environmental due diligence. I'm Jason Chaney, Due Diligence Discipline Lead with SME, and I'm joined again by Dave Guevara, partner and insurance recovery guru with Taft Law, and Brett Stuntz, SME's Discipline Lead for Brownfield Incentives. We're going to focus today's talk on alternative methods to pay for cleanup of environmental issues. Dave, it's great to have you back.
Jason, thank you. It's great to be back.
And Brett, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks, Jason. Glad to be here.
So Dave, in episode one, we talked about environmental liability. Say we've been exposed to environmental liability. I'm a buyer of a piece of property and we didn't do our phase one, so we're not a BFPP. During our redevelopment activities, we find something and now the state or EPA is looking for us to clean it up. What options are out there to pay for it?
Jason, that's a great question. You'll recall in episode one, we talked about modern environmental law. And you'll recall that modern environmental law came into being in the 1970s. The EPA was created in 1970. And between 1970 and 1979, the entire framework of federal environmental law was created. So for instance, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act were all enacted between 1970 and 1979. And the purpose, you will recall, Jason, of these laws was to regulate the use of hazardous substances and petroleum in the future so that hazardous substances and petroleum would be managed in a way to decrease the probability of an accidental release in the future. So these statutes, Jason, as we discussed, were and are regulatory statutes. They're forward-looking, the purpose of which is to decrease the probability of an accidental release of contamination into the environment. Then, in 1980, a sea change in environmental law occurred with the enactment of CERCLA, the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Enforcement Act, which is an enforcement statute. In other words, Jason, rather than regulating the use of hazardous substances, CERCLA makes parties liable to clean up contamination. Its purpose is to clean up past and future releases of hazardous substances. And as we discussed in episode one, liability under CERCLA is draconian. And as I explained in episode one, this is because one, its liability scheme is wide in scope. It ensnares parties, for instance, who had nothing whatsoever to do with the release of the contamination. Two, its liability is strict, which means it's not based upon fault. And three, it's joint and several. So, Jason, as you asked, let's say you're ensnared in CERCLA's draconian liability scheme. How are you going to pay for the cost to perform the cleanup that is required of you? Well, a principal way, Jason, to pay for the cleanup required of you under CERCLA or any state's version of CERCLA or any other environmental claim is through insurance. Now, most people think that it is a property insurance policy that responds to environmental liability claims. But Jason, it is not. It's a commercial general liability policy that responds to environmental liability claims. And if you think about it, Jason, it's clear why. A general liability policy responds, just as the name suggests, to legal liability on account of property damage due to environmental contamination. And just to take a step back, Jason, as you know, the purpose of insurance is to protect the insured from the risk of certain unpredictable events. So for instance, life insurance protects against premature death. Automobile insurance protects against automobile-related injuries. And property insurance protects against damage to property caused by a covered peril, such as fire. Well, the unpredictable event against which general liability insurance provides protection is a lawsuit or the threat of a lawsuit. Thus, as I said, a general liability policy responds to legal liability on account of property damage due to environmental contamination. So, Jason, in a general liability policy, there are several important parts, but one of the most important, in fact, the beating heart of an insurance policy is the insuring agreement. And the insuring agreement in a general liability policy generally states something like this: we will pay those sums the insured becomes legally obligated to pay as damages because of property damage to which this insurance applies. So the question, Jason, is to what type of property damage does the insurance apply? Well, it applies to property damage, Jason, that is not otherwise excluded. An exclusion, Jason, in an insurance policy is a specific exemption to the general scope of coverage created by the insuring agreement. So that insuring agreement was broad in scope. And to limit that, there are in these policies these exclusions, which are exceptions to that general scope of coverage provided by the insuring agreement. So, for example, Jason, the insuring agreement is a promise by the insurer to pay money that the insured becomes legally obligated to pay as damages because of property damage. But the promise does not extend to liability for property damage due to war. So there's a war exclusion. So while the insuring agreement would otherwise be broad enough to apply to property damage on account of war, because of the exclusion, it will not respond to liability on account of property damage in that context. Now, in the pollution context, the exclusion that's applicable is the pollution exclusion. So the question is, does the pollution exclusion exclude environmental liability claims? And the answer is, it depends on what state's law applies. So for instance, Indiana law has established a principle that where the definition of pollution in a liability policy is overbroad, it is considered ambiguous and unenforceable. Therefore, even though there's an exclusion for pollution-related claims in the policy, the exclusion does not preclude coverage for environmental cleanup claims. So in Indiana, the pollution exclusion, if it were held to be vague and ambiguous and therefore unenforceable, would not be an effective bar to coverage if, under the circumstances that you described, the EPA or a state agency sent a notice of liability to you requiring you to perform environmental response actions. Now, Jason, an insurance policy is just a contract, and each state has its own contract law, and therefore each state handles the pollution exclusion differently. So whether the pollution exclusion functions as an effective bar to coverage is a state law question. And each state has developed different principles for in interpreting an insurance policy and, in particular, the pollution exclusion. But, Jason, the pollution exclusion was first introduced in the mid-1970s. So prior to this time, general liability policies did not explicitly exclude coverage for pollution-related claims. So if there is a situation in which there was a release of contamination predating the pollution exclusion, then that would not be, that particular exclusion obviously wouldn't be a bar to coverage because it wouldn't be in an insurance policy. And that raises, Jason, this issue of a continuous trigger of coverage. And what that is, Jason, is a legal doctrine that has been applied in the context of general liability insurance policies to determine whether coverage is available for certain types of losses. And under this doctrine, damage caused by an ongoing continuous process, such as environmental pollution, triggers multiple policy periods, even if the damage, the harm, the environmental contamination did not manifest itself until many, many years after the initial release. So for example, Jason, suppose a company used trichloroethylene in its manufacturing process, which caused a release into the environment 100 years ago. And let's say the contamination was not discovered until today. The damage will trigger all the policies in effect during the years of exposure. So this means that each policy that was in effect during the 100 years of exposure could potentially provide coverage for the resulting damage, even if the policies have already expired. And the reason why is because general liability policies are generally occurrence-based policies as opposed to claims-based policies. And the difference there, Jason, is that an occurrence-based policy provides coverage for losses that occur during the policy period, regardless of when the claim is actually made. And on the other hand, a claims-based policy provides coverage only for claims that are actually made during the policy period. So that is why if there has been a situation in which contamination was released prior to the mid-1970s, the likelihood of having to address the pollution exclusion as a potential bar to coverage in a general liability policy is likely not going to be present. So the principal way to pay for environmental cleanup costs in the scenario you described would be insurance, although it's a very fact-specific analysis that needs to occur in order to make a determination as to whether or not that coverage is actually available. Now, there are other ways to pay for environmental cleanup costs, but before I talk about those, do you have any questions?
Yeah, Dave, that was great. So a couple of things. First, so can the entity that caused the release benefit from the insurance, or does it have to be a buyer after that person?
So it's the policy is only triggered for the insured under the policy who is exposed to liability. So they'll be the policy holder and any additional insureds.
Okay.
I had a question about the exclusions. You listed a couple. I'm wondering how negligence would fit into these situations. Is that something that typically kicks you out of being able to utilize an insurance policy, or is there potentially still a application?
That's a great question. And so insurance spread is based on the principle of fortuity, right? So there has to be an accident that triggers the insurance. So let's say, you were so negligent, that you dumped over a barrel of PCE, a 55-gallon barrel, because, you were upset at your boss and poured that out. That would not be an accidental fortuitous event that would trigger insurance coverage. So that's a great question. In a context like that, you would be hard pressed to find coverage.
So Dave, is there any out of pocket expense for somebody that's going after this coverage? Like, what do you have to do up front once, say, contamination's identified?
So that is a great question, Jason. So the very first thing that you want to do is identify all of the insurers who are on the risk. So any of those insurers, when I was talking about the continuous trigger, you want to identify the earliest date on which the release of the contamination occurred. Once you've identified that set of insurers, you want to put them all on notice of the claim against you, whether that claim against you is by the EPA, a state agency, or a private party, and request coverage from all of those insurers.
So in your experience, how are these things typically triggered? Are they typically a government action like state or EPA? Or are they typically another private party? Is it evenly a mix between the three?
Well, I would say the lion's share of instances where insurance comes into play as a mechanism for paying for environmental cleanup costs is because either the EPA has made a claim or a state environmental agency has made a claim. But private party claims can trigger coverage as well. Private parties can sue under CERCLA, they can sue under RCRA, or they can raise toxic torts. And in that context, Brett, a toxic tort is negligence, and that would trigger insurance. Now, the example we were talking about earlier was sort of a hyperbolic extreme example of negligence, but most aren't going to be like that. And those normal standard sort of negligence claims will certainly trigger insurance.
So Brett, here at SMB, you've got a bit of a different focus. You're on our brownfield incentives team and look for other ways to get funding for cleanup for our developer clients and everything else. So, maybe in this case, we're a BFPP as a developer. We do find something when we're out there. How do we get that paid for? A lot of times, that can maybe not make a deal work if we've got a bunch of money we have to account for cleanup. How do we make that work?
There are a number of ways. The first thing that we typically do is try to understand the issues from a technical perspective and how to solve them for the things that we have expertise in, so geotechnical and environmental and civil design. And if we can engineer an efficient way to solve those problems, that often goes a long way toward getting through a problem that's been intractable in the past. But that doesn't necessarily work on its own. We work with a lot of grants and loans, public-private partnerships, where essentially projects are subsidized in one way or another, or through tools like tax increment financing or tax abatements that are applicable in certain situations and can reduce risk on redevelopment. So one of the things that arises when we look at those types of incentives, and I'm curious about how it would impact projects with insurance recovery, is timing and the ability to coordinate the process with other parts of the redevelopment. So if we're looking at permitting for a site or financing for a site, maybe a grant or a loan, even though, you know, a low interest loan, let's say a publicly sourced loan, it might not fit, depending on, you know, because it would take longer or have certain requirements or restrictions. So I'm curious about insurance recovery and a redevelopment perspective. Is it something that, you know, if you have a new entity, like you mentioned, Jason, someone with a liability exemption that's coming in, but has issues redeveloping the site because of the extraordinary cost due to contamination that was caused by another entity, what's the timing impact to start a lawsuit or look at the regulatory process and look at insurance recovery as maybe a mechanism to help out with the development?
So Brett, that's a great question. And you answered it in part with your question when you, in your setup, said that the party that is redeveloping the property is exempt from liability. So if it's exempt from liability, then insurance for that party is irrelevant, right? Because as I discussed, the general liability policy responds to claims against the insured, asserting that it is liable for environmental cleanup costs, either again under CERCLA or some other federal statute or a state statute or a toxic tort. And so if you're not exposed to that sort of claim, then you wouldn't have a claim on your insurer. But it's a great question and a question that developers face all the time. So for instance, let's say that I am a well-informed developer who understands that in buying a brownfield, it's prudent for me to qualify for the bona fide prospective purchaser defense, which we discussed in episode one, and that in fact I do qualify for the bona fide prospective purchaser defense. Well, I would be exempt from CERCLA liability, but that doesn't mean I'm not going to incur environmental response costs because some of my post-acquisition duties to maintain the bona fide prospective purchaser defense is to perform continuing obligations, which in a nutshell can be summed up as saying, one, prevent a future release, two, stop a continuing release, and three, prevent exposure to previously released hazardous substances. Well, let's say, you know, that there was a release of contamination on the property prior to the developer's ownership. It's discovered during the developer's redevelopment operations, and that, you know, there clearly are going to be exceedances in an above ground structure in the indoor air of some particular contaminant. Well, a continuing obligation, as we just said, would be to prevent exposure to previously released hazardous substances, and therefore the developer is going to have to spend extra money to install some sort of mitigation system. And so the question is, how does the developer recover those costs? Well, one way is for the developer to seek recovery of those environmental response costs from the responsible party. And the developer can do that under CERCLA. There's a private party can bring a suit under CERCLA as a cost recovery action or a contribution action, or the developer can sue under a state toxic tort claim, negligence, nuisance, perhaps trespass. And there may be state statutes that allow for a person who has incurred environmental response costs to seek those environmental response costs from the party that caused the contamination.
I'm thinking of properties where you look at the site history and there might be liable parties sitting out there. Very often, there aren't necessarily enforcement actions from the state or from the EPA, presumably because they've got limited bandwidth for that sort of thing or resources. So is that a viable redevelopment strategy, looking for properties with potentially viable liable parties and looking for potential insurance policies sitting out there to be tapped in those instances?
Oh, certainly. Absolutely. And I think a well-informed purchaser of any property, or I should say any brownfield, should certainly do that spade work before acquiring the property. In other words, doing the research needed to make a determination as to whether or not there are parties after whom cost recovery can be sought. Now, let's say, Brett, that you are a developer who buys a brownfield, discovers contamination, and decides to sue a responsible party. That responsible party can tender your claim to its general liability insurer and seek recovery of insurance vis-a-vis your claim. So it doesn't have to be just the EPA or a state environmental agency who sues. A private party can trigger insurance in the environmental context too.
So Dave, is that a negotiation strategy you can have during, you know, the the acquisition process, you know? I mean, or is, what does that look like? Is it okay?
Certainly, if you're buying the property from, if you're buying the property from a party who caused the contamination, you certainly will factor in the contamination and the cost to address the contamination into the terms of the purchase agreement, which can be, you know, included in there in a number of ways. But absolutely, it is something that should be part of the negotiations that result in terms in a purchase agreement.
So when we're talking with people that are looking to buy a property and, you know, we have access, but is it okay for them to ask that seller, do you have past insurance policies? Can I get a copy of those?
Absolutely. And that's part of that spade work I was talking about, right? So let's say that the only asset that the seller has is the property and insurance policies. Well, you know, you're going to want to make sure that those insurance policies, in the event that you seek recovery of response costs from the seller, are going to be available for the seller to satisfy the value of your claim.
How long do these processes typically take to go through insurance recovery?
Another great question, right? So it's like anything else, there's a scale, and you, in an ideal situation, let's say that you are exposed to a claim, an environmental liability claim, and you tender a claim to your insurer and say, you know, I've been sued, or there's the, you know, somebody is threatening to sue me on account of releases of contamination that the party is claiming that I caused or contributed to. I want coverage. Well, in an ideal situation, you know, within, you know, the insurer obviously has to do its own due diligence, has to look into the merits of the claim. The duty to defend is broader than their duty to indemnify, which we haven't talked about, but we can. And so once they make a determination as to whether or not the insurer, that is, has a duty to provide a defense, the insurer will let you know, and hopefully that will occur in a matter of weeks. But if it's a complicated situation, it may take the insurer longer to make a determination, and the insurer may decline coverage, in which case, you know, if the insured thinks that their claim has merit, the insured may want to consider a declaratory judgment action against the insured or against the insurer, and the insurer may file a declaratory judgment action against the insured, seeking a declaration from the court that it doesn't owe any coverage to the insured. So there, that's sort of that scale, you know, from getting a positive response on defense within a few weeks to, you know, in several weeks or several months, ending up in a declaratory judgment lawsuit.
I'm thinking of now situations where insurance recovery has been successful, and what is the role of the regulatory agencies as far as the work that is then performed? Are they coming in on the back end to make some kind of determination of satisfaction?
No. So if No. So if this state or federal government is the party that's making the claim, you know, depending on what specific, you know, state program you're in, whether it's a, you know, enforcement cleanup program or a voluntary program or what sort of agreement you enter into with the EPA, it's the agency that is going to make the determinations as to the timing and the, you know, for cleanup and the standards required to be met. The insurer and the insured have to work together to ensure that they are adequately satisfying those demands from the regulator.
So, Dave, in your experience, are the insurers willing to work with the state agencies to involve them early on in the process to just kind of talk about what needs to be done? You know, in our experience, involving the state early typically leads to a more cost-effective cleanup, right? We're not going out and doing something and then they're coming back and saying, no, go do more, right? So is that something insurers have been willing to do?
Oh, I think so. And in the, you know, the insurance adjuster, the claims adjuster, oftentimes is going to have to rely on an environmental professional and will retain the services of an environmental consultant who generally has, you know, deep experience in dealing with these sort of claims and understands that working with the state or federal government in a situation like this to streamline the process is the most efficient way of proceeding.
Can you speak to situations where, let's say, you have a BFPP that's coming in to redevelop a property where there's a previous owner who has liability exposure and there's an insurance recovery role for that liable party, but the redevelopment of the BFPP sort of intersects with the cleanup? So for example, you might have a dig and haul to clean up the site, but the redevelopment would do some level of source removal independent of that, just as part of the redevelopment. Would the insurance potentially be recovery be reduced because of that development project? Is it immaterial?
I would think so. No, I would think so. And I think the way to review that would be kind of think of it through Venn diagrams. So you have one circle that are your environmental response costs, and you have one circle that represents development costs. And where they overlap, I would think that the insurer is going to make a strong and likely successful argument that those are development costs and not environmental response costs. And that would make sense. I mean, there may be some grounds to push back on that. But, you know, if you're going to put a shovel in the ground and remove a shovel full of dirt for redevelopment purposes, but it just so happens that you're also ridding the soil of contamination, that is a discussion that should occur with the insurer regarding how to categorize those costs.
So that's leads me, Dave, to what happens if you overdo it, right? What if we look at this and something like that does happen and the insurer says, hey, no, we're not paying this because of X? What are our options at that point?
So hopefully you avoid that situation altogether by preparing scopes of work that are presented to and approved by the insurer and its oversight consultant before performing the work. But certainly there are times when there may be a disagreement as to the, you know, scope of work proposed or the technologies used to achieve the intended goal or the costs associated with that. And those are just regular conversations that you have to have with the insurer and come to a meeting of the minds on. But let's say for some reason there was a scope of work performed that wasn't, you know, reviewed and approved by the insurer beforehand, and the insurer for some reason is claiming that for one reason or another it isn't obligated to pay for that. Well, I mean, that's a discussion that needs to happen with the insurer. And at some point, you know, if the insurer believes the insurer is wrong, then the insured would have a breach of contract claim against the insurer.
Dave, you mentioned earlier that the suitability of insurance recovery as a tool is in part dependent on state law, I think, as it applied to exclusions maybe. But I guess as a general question, are there certain states that insurance recovery is a better tool or a more useful tool than others because of state law?
Yes, that's a great question. And I would say, you know, again, looking at this on sort of a sliding scale, on one side, if it is, you know, the best states for recovery of insurance because of the state's development of its contract law, and in particular, the ways in which it interprets an insurance policy, would be Indiana. And then you have sort of a sliding scale downwards from there. So for instance, some states would say the pollution exclusion that I had or the definition of pollutants that I had referenced earlier, while Indiana considers that vague and ambiguous, other states may say that that is clear and interpret it and apply it in a way to make the pollution exclusion effective as a band of coverage.
So is that like a court determination in Indiana that that language is ambiguous and subject to revisiting potentially? Or?
Yep, that's absolutely correct. Contract law is by and large judicially developed, though the insurers have certainly lobbied Indiana and probably all states for, you know, statutes requiring a certain interpretation of insurance policies.
And then flipping this around, does any of this that we're discussing have implications about how people, companies should shop for insurance or purchase environmental liability or commercial general liability insurance in terms of the nature of the policies or any nuances between different types of insurance?
Absolutely. And if you have a client who is interested in potentially, you know, maximizing its insurance in the context of an environmental liability claim, I think that they will want to consult with a professional to make a determination as to what sort of policies are more likely than not going to respond in, you know, the context of environmental policy, but also whether you're getting a pollution legal liability policy or some other policy.
All right. Well, Dave, Brett, thank you so much for being part of this podcast today. We will continue on with a couple more episodes in this series, and we'll have other guests with us. So thank you both, and we look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you, Dave. It's been great.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you, Brett.
Thank you for listening to the Build and Revitalize podcast series on environmental due diligence, produced by SME. And thank you to all of our guests for sharing their insights and perspectives. If you have questions about environmental issues, you can connect with Jason Chaney, Brett Stuntz, Dave Guevara, or Arthur Siegel on LinkedIn. Or visit www.sme-usa.com and www.taftlaw.com to learn more. Be sure to subscribe to Build and Revitalize on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And don't forget to visit www.sme-usa.com/podcast to join the conversation, access show notes, and catch up on our previous episodes. While you're at it, connect with SME USA on LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube.